Hello and welcome to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances from our special Bowery perspective. At Bowery, we start every event with an honor native land statement. We would like to acknowledge that Bowery Poetry Club rests on the traditional lands and waters of the Lenape people, and we give respect to the Lenape and their elders past, present, and future by speaking in the Lenape language, Anushik, which means thank you and welcome. Anushik.
In this episode, host Yana Ellis speaks with German author Selim Özdoğan and translators Katie Derbyshire and Aysa Türkoğlu about 52 Factory Lane, the second book in the Anatolian Blues trilogy.
It's a great pleasure to have on Trafika Europe Radio today German author Selim Özdoğan, who was born in Cologne in 1971. He knew he wanted to be a writer from the age of 14. He started publishing novels, short stories, audiobooks in 1995 and has won numerous prizes and grants. His latest crime novel, Der die Träume hört, Hearing the Dreams, has been translated into Italian and is being adapted for film. Selim, hello and welcome.
Hello, nice to be here.
Lovely to have you. We also have with us in the studio today Aysa Türkoğlu, who is a writer and literary translator based in North London. She translates from German and Turkish into English. Her translation interests include the literature of the Turkish diaspora in Germany and minority literatures in Turkey. Aysa, hello and welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Hello. And last but not least, Katie Derbyshire, who is a British-born Berlin-based translator and writer. Katie translates contemporary German fiction and is a publisher at V&Q Books. Her published works include books by Clemens Meyer, Christoph Wolff, Heike Geisler and Olga Krasnyanova. Her translation of Bricks and Mortar by Clemens Meyer was longlisted for the 2017 Man Booker Prize and won the 2018 Strelinger Prize for Translation. Katie Derbyshire has also served on the jury of Germany's Internationale Literaturpreis and the International Dublin Literary Award. In addition, Katie was instrumental in establishing the Warwick Prize for Women in Translation, awarded annually since 2017. She has also been a vocal supporter of the Women in Translation movement and the creation of Women in Translation Month. Katie, hello and welcome.
Hi, Yana. Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming. Selim, I would like to start with asking you a question about, can you please give us a little bit of background to this book? For those who are not familiar with the series, if you could tell us how the Anatolian Blues trilogy was born, so the listeners can place the characters in the timeline as well. And of course, Katie and Aysa, just come in anytime you like to add anything.
The first part of the trilogy, The Blacksmith's Daughter, takes place in the 30s, 40s, 50s and 60s in a small town in Anatolia and tells us about the main character, Gül, growing up and her mother dying when she's at an early age. Well, basically, it's what village life was in Anatolia back then. And that's based on the stories I heard when I was a kid. And when I wrote that, I thought that wouldn't be a trilogy. It was 3 years after it came out that I, for reasons, decided it would have a second and a third part. And the second part is 52 Factory Lane. And is married, has two little kids, and follows her husband to Germany, who's working there. And so we just follow her, see what her life is like as a grown-up, as a mother, how she is longing to get back home, how home is in a way lost. Yes.
And there's also, I'm just going to butt in here, there's also a lot about her family and friends. So she's the oldest of several children, and she then gets a stepmother, and then there's her in-laws, and then when she moves to Germany, there are various friends of hers, and this kind of her private world just expands and expands. So Aysa and I are currently working on the final part, which is the end of the last third of her life, I would say. And we follow a lot of those characters right through. I think we've both become very fond of them, haven't we, Aicha?
Yes, I'm very attached. I don't want to leave them.
Gül is very sweet, and I think it's very difficult not to like her or to warm up to her, because I find her and the whole novel is very warm, and there's kind of a feeling of home in it as well. Of a person who needs to go through day-to-day life, which is not necessarily very easy, but somehow manages to navigate the currents and achieve what she needs to achieve to what society, I suppose in many cases, at the start at least, is expecting of her. So we do learn a lot about customs and traditions, I think, of that part of the world from Anatolia, and then how foreigners were accepted in Germany.
Yes, but that's just, well, one way of summing up the book would be, for me, Gül is trying to make connections, satisfying connections with other people. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't work. It doesn't seem to work with her husband, but that's my main focus when writing. I try to understand that character. I try to feel that character. And because of the setting, you get to know some culture, some cultural differences, and so forth. But my main focus is really, what's beneath that cultural level? What's the layer beneath that?
The person and the human being underneath it.
Yes.
And I think when we're translating, I certainly have to say, I feel very close to particularly Gül, having accompanied her once a year throughout her life. And I really hope that readers get that too, that kind of intimacy that we build up over the course of the books, but even over the course of each single book. They're just very affectionate portraits.
I like you calling it portraits, actually, because I think they are portraits, but it's almost like when I read the first and then the second, I'm looking forward to the third in the trilogy because I need to know what's happening. Because you start caring for her, and you really want life to turn out all right for her, and you want for her to be happy, and you almost, you know, it's like living with her life, and you're growing with her in a way as a human being, and making those connections, I suppose, as Salim said. But personally for me, you know, it's when she has some mishaps, I find myself irritated. As in, it's painful sometimes, isn't
yeah.
it?
Oh, yeah.
When she has mishaps, it's painful.
Yeah.
I think I was quite frustrated with her when I first started reading her. I felt, just stick up for yourself. Why are you letting people just walk all over you? But that's probably because I'm more like Melike, except less tough. But that's her sister. But then she's got like a kind of a deep-seated like strength, I think, that you see as the books develop. And she's like a rock. She just like endures and things like wash over her in a good way. She's like a rock in a good way.
And she gives back to people. She's more animate than a rock. She's a great endurer. Yeah.
Yeah. But she doesn't become like hardened or anything. She's always soft. She stays soft. And one thing I was thinking about earlier is, you know, she's quite like she's what was born in like the 40s. So she's quite... like she comes to Germany with these sort of, I don't want to be patronising, but it's quite provincial, quite old-fashioned-y kind of values. But she doesn't like, that's not something that's like integral to her. Like she's always accepting of people. In the second book, there's some bit where Jeren's friend's brother goes to, or someone uses a toilet, one of her daughter's friends uses the toilet while her brother is in the shower or something, and Gül is absolutely shocked, but she's also like, they don't know any different, that's their culture. It's very accepting.
I find her very kind.
Yeah.
I think if I had to use just one adjective to describe Gül, I think she's very kind and, yes, accepting. And there's another passage where she shows, women don't do these things, when she's in the factory. So wants to go to the toilet and she was frightened to get lost. And then another lady goes with her. I don't want to give too much away. People need to read it, I think, but it was quite funny.
Oh, there's a lot of funny moments.
Yes, just there are a lot of funny.
Like in life, like in everybody's life, you know, when you've got an eye for it.
Yeah. There's a lot of fun and there's sorrow, but there's always a lightness to it that comes on the top of it. Would you like to read to us an excerpt from the book?
Yes, but before I read, I have to say that I really enjoy this kind of, I'm not talking too much, everybody's saying good things about the book, and it sounds like, yes, sounds like a good book to me. Maybe I should read it.
Yeah, maybe you should. You've not read it yet.
Not the whole of it in English, but I vaguely remember reading the German one sometime when I was young. Yes, I'm reading what is already being proofread by me. Little rant, which we are going to hear in English afterwards. Kaum fassbar, beim Saubermachen. Einmal die Woche kommt die Sendung und du machst ausgerechnet am Samstag die Antenne kaputt? Hatte das nicht Zeit bis Montag? Einmal die Woche sitzen wir hier schön zusammen und bekommen erzählt, was in der Heimat los ist. Einmal die Woche. Andere Frauen fallen beim Fensterputzen auf die Straße und meine zerstört die Antenne. Mit Gewalt hast du daran gezerrt, das sieht man doch. Das nennst du sauber machen? Dich sollte man nicht mal in die Nähe von elektrischen Geräten lassen. Nicht mal ein Bügeleisen sollte dir erlaubt sein. Einmal die Woche sehe ich mir eine schöne, schlanke Ansagerin an, weil meine Frau so fett ist, dass sie die Antenne aus dem Fernseher reißt. Versuch's doch mal mit einer Diät. Den ganzen Nachmittag geht das schon so. Gül lässt ihn zetern, wie er möchte, denkt sich Antworten aus, die ungesagt bleiben, und lächelt in sich hinein, weil Vader und Jaden auf der Straße spielen, ohne etwas abzukriegen, aber irgendwann hat auch sie genug. Es ist doch deine Schuld, sagt sie, dass sie noch erstaunter über die Anschuldigung, die er nie zuvor zu hören bekommen. Noch bevor ihm eine Antwort einfällt, sagt Gül, du bist doch mit dieser Pille angekommen. Hier, ich hab was für dich, da müssen wir nicht mehr aufpassen, ohne dass ich bei einem Arzt gewesen wäre. Von diesen Pillen bin ich so auseinandergegangen, von diesen Hormonen oder was es ist. Wer weiß, wo du die Dinger her hast. Und überhaupt, kann ja sein, dass du keine dicken Frauen magst, kann ja sein, dass du eine schöne, schlanke Blonde willst, aber soll ich dir mal was sagen? Ich mag Männer, die Haare auf dem Kopf haben und nicht welche mit Glatze.
That's the first time I've heard you read the second bit in German. Very enjoyable.
Thank you, Salim. And Aicha and Katie, would you like to now read the English translation of this passage and a bit longer? First.
Sure, I'm going to leave it to Aicha. But
you sure?
Ahead. Yeah.
Okay. It beggars belief. Well, you were cleaning. Once a week the program's on and you go and break the aerial on a Saturday. Couldn't it wait till Monday? Once a week we sit here nice and cosy together and they tell us what's going on back home. Once a week. Other women fall out onto the street while they're cleaning the windows and my wife has to go and destroy the aerial. You must have tugged pretty hard at it. That's what you call cleaning, is it? You shouldn't be allowed anywhere near electrical devices. You shouldn't even be allowed an iron. Once a week, I watch a lovely, slim presenter, not like my wife, who's so fat she rips the aerial off the telly. Why don't you try dieting? It's been like this all afternoon. Gu lets him moan as much as he likes, thinking up answers that go unsaid and smiling to herself because she knows Jada and Jen playing outside, out of harm's way. But after a while, she's had enough. It's your fault I'm so fat. Fuat stares at her, amazed she's suddenly answering back. He's even more amazed by her accusation, which he's never heard before. Before he can come up with a response, Gul tells him, it was you who came along with the pill. Here you go, I've got something for you so we don't have to be careful anymore. Without me going to see a doctor. It's those pills that have made me swell up, those hormones or whatever they are. Who knows where you got them? And anyway, maybe you don't like fat women. Maybe you do want a slim, blonde wife. But shall I tell you something for a change? I like men with hair on their heads, not baldies. You can't always pick and choose what you want. You get, you hear me? Men with a full head of hair. Fuat jerks his glass upwards, but he doesn't pull back to hit her. Gul stands in front of him and looks him in the eye. And before the defeat she sees there turns into disaster, she leaves the room. Later that evening, Yilmaz will say to Fuat, that's how I like it. You're learning to drink now, my friend. Just savouring it in peace, not getting louder with every sip you take. And Sanye will say to Gul, it's better, honest. The old one drank and beat me, and this one just drinks. God forbid, but if I ever marry again, perhaps the Lord will send me a husband who doesn't do either. But who knows what flaws he'd have then? A man like Ser Ted, who's lost his marbles, isn't what you'd want either. Your lahmacun is delicious, by the way. May your hands always be healthy. Fuat will never say anything about Gül's figure again, nor Gül about his bald head. Women might pose in front of the mirror to inspect their new clothes or put on makeup, but it's men who are made vulnerable by vanity.
That was lovely. Thank you so much. Thank you. I really enjoyed this, and I hope everybody else is enjoying it well, enjoyed it whilst they're listening to it. So earlier you said, Aicha, that Gül is solid like a rock. She's not always soft. And do you think that in this passage we really see how she's now had enough and she's not necessarily going to back down this time?
I suppose so. I suppose it's part of the development that you see in her in the second book, is that she starts to stand up to Fuat in these like little ways. Would you agree, Katie?
Yeah, I think she picks her battle. I think she's a pragmatic kind of person, and she, like many mothers, she's really concerned about her children's welfare, and she'll put up with a lot of nonsense from her husband for the sake of the children. And then sometimes she will indeed lose it and really stand up to him, which continues throughout her life. It's really quite fascinating, actually, that relationship that they have.
Maybe because none of her husbands found a really not enjoyable character. And writing Gü was easy in a way. But when I started the second novel, it was like, okay, I have to make this guy somehow lovable for the reader. And everything we said is true, but I put quite some work into it. So he is at least funny in some ways. And I don't know what you two would like to add or not to add.
He's not just funny, though. He's got that, like, he's not, I don't think he has interpersonal qualities, but, like, he's got, like, personal qualities. Like, he's got that energy and, like, that sort of, that to get things done that Gül really doesn't have. And that, I think, is explored more in the second book and in the third book. And it's like when you're talking about a relative who you love, but who's basically horrible, and you're trying to find things about them that are good. And they're not necessarily good for you, but they're good in some way. And I think it's in that way that Fuat is good. Get stuff done.
Get stuff done and stands as much as I suppose he can by his family, at least financially. Not always. I suppose we have to exclude the drinking escapades.
Yeah, I mean...
He does go to work.
Let's say he goes to work.
He does go to work. The bar is not very high here, but he does go to work.
He's a great character to translate, though, with the translator hat on. And you hear when I just started that passage, he has this catchphrase, "beggars belief," which just every time I type it or I read it, it makes me laugh. Now he has an amazing way with words, which is just such fun to put into English.
Yeah,
so that
really,
made
really
me
fun.
More fond of him. Yeah.
But because of the language he speaks.
Yeah, definitely.
And how he made, well, I suppose as a translator, it would make you laugh and then it much lighter to translate a not such a nice character as Gül, for example. Were there any particular challenges you two found when you were working together? First of all, how do you work as two translators on the same text? And then, were there any particular challenges, Katie, you found, and was there something else challenging for you, Aicha?
The way we work, the two of us, the novels have this kind of episodic anecdotal structure. So we just divided them up and we took turns doing one section each. And they're not particularly long, so we get a kind of a pace going once we get on the roll where we will kind of ping pong these sections between us. So say I just did the first one, she sends me it, I read it and I send her my translation of the next bit. And so we're in a constant dialogue and we can make changes as we're going along, and we can say, oh wait, no, I think earlier on we called this thing, we chose mummy rather than mum or something like that, probably the other way around in that case. And that really suited the book. And I hadn't done a co-translation before I worked with Aicha. So we kind of made it up as we went along, but it proved very productive, I think. And the challenge, often I find the challenge is the way the characters think and speak is different to the way characters think and speak in a lot of the German novels that I've translated. Particularly Goethe has all these kind of kind, deep thoughts about the nature of humans. And I find it a challenge to put that into English without it sounding kitsch. And I hope that I manage that, or that we manage that. Some of the time, and I think Ayça can speak to this more than I can, there are kind of hidden Turkish phrases which sound perfectly normal in German, but then have to come into English again. And sometimes that second hurdle, I find that quite difficult. Can you tell us about that, Ayça? Because I can't spot those. May not be obvious. I don't speak any Turkish, so I can't spot them.
I don't think I can spot them either, really. I mean, I thought I could, but now I think, no, I can spot them because they're like, you think, like, sometimes in the first book, there was that instance, I think I mentioned this in the launch of the first book, there was an instance where a character dies and they're talking about her and they're saying she wanted to, what was it? She wanted to have 2 days in bed and then the third day be in the ground. And apparently that's a Turkish saying. I didn't know. It just slipped by me because I just thought it was part of the text. But my mum pointed out to me and said that is something that your nene used to say, that she wanted to be in the ground on the third day. So sometimes I spot them. But I think sometimes I think they're quite obvious. They're kind of highlighted because they're elements of speech that don't really exist in lots of other cultural settings. But then maybe they are, like, I sometimes think about translating the Turkish, like what you say before a meal or after a meal or during a meal. If you say afiyet olsun when someone's like going to eat, I was thinking, oh, we don't have that. It's not like bon appetit. It's not quite that. But then I've seen people translate it sometimes as dig in or tuck in.
Oh, nice.
Which is not even, you couldn't say that in every circumstance to someone. No. You couldn't walk past someone's,
you wouldn't,
like,
say it in a restaurant, would you?
No. And you wouldn't, like you wouldn't walk past someone's summer house veranda and see that they're eating and be like, tuck in. I cannot remember where I got onto that. But yeah, but we made our way around it. But I feel like my approach to translating the sort of hidden Turkish in the book changes all the time. Sometimes I'm like, I want this to be really obvious that this is coming from Turkish. And sometimes I just say, no, let's just hide it. Let's just make it sound like a normal part of speech because that sounds more natural. And I haven't decided what I prefer.
I think we try and play with rhythm though sometimes for those parts that we're like, okay, it has to have a kind of bounce in English that it usually has in German as well. And I presume had in Turkish. And I think there we're like, sometimes I think, I remember you once looking for something that rhymed, Ayça.
Yeah.
And but all we'll work with has to sound a bit pithy.
Yeah, like, I don't even know if it definitely rhymed in Turkish, but there will have been elements in it in Turkish that were like repeated. And so like in English, the easiest way to do that is to rhyme.
Turkish is important to come through as well, isn't it? Because it's got a very strong sense of place, gives identity in a way. Or what these people, because if you move from one culture to another, you always bring something with you.
I think Selim will massively disagree with that. No, why not?
Really? Yeah. So that's the way you learn to express yourself, and that's culture. But I always think, and I wouldn't disagree with you, but it's just like about, to me, it's about layers. And the more the person you are is, well, you have to express yourself through the culture you've grown up, but you would be in a way, be the same person in a different culture, and you would express yourself differently and maybe have different values, but your approach to life, your energies, your, call it character, would be the same. So I don't think that really changes. It's just the, like, culture is just the stage. And then there is the play, but the characters can be moved from one can't really, but theoretically you can move them just to another stage and they're still the same person. But then you have to make adjustments because the stage is a completely different stage.
I like that way of putting it, a stage and a play, and the play is different. It's just the stage, so they can move. And I understand what you're saying by the person is the same. But as you say, a person has to express themselves the way they have learned to express themselves. And whether they adapt or not, then, of course, it's personal choice.
Yeah, no and, stage, no play. They do.
Yeah. Thank you. So, Selim, you mentioned that music plays quite a big part in your creative process, to all three of you, not just for you. You named the trilogy Anatolian Blues. Can you tell us how music influences you when you're working on this particular book?
Well, different ways I could try to explain that, but maybe one way is one thing I remember from my childhood, when I was like, I don't know, 6, 7, 8 years of age, my mother was like, you can't sing. Which might have been true at that time, but which was not a very nice thing to say. But I always loved the possibility of being able to sing, of expressing your emotions in that way. So I could say, in a way, I'm writing because my mother said I cannot sing. Otherwise, I would have become a singer and everything would have been fine and wouldn't have. It's like, how many words does a song have? And what do I do when I write a novel? Not entirely and exactly true, but that's just one way of saying it's, in a way, the most important thing. If we try to break it down, we say that everything started with a big bang. So it started with sound. And when we're communicating, when we're talking now, it's sound. And speaking, speech, language is already music in a way. Yeah, my biggest influence is music, but music not like we have this entertainment industry and we're selling songs to people. Music is a much broader term for me.
More to do with sound and the rhythm different sounds create.
Yes, yes. If you can't tell the words, but you know a language and you hear people talking in the other room, you usually know what it's about. When it's a different language, you might not know because it sounds different to you, but when you're in that sound, you understand without understanding the words. And what I saw with my children when they were smaller and started speaking, understood quite a lot. And the more words they knew and the more words were missing, they started understanding less because they try to understand every single word and they don't know all the words. So it was in a way easier for a short period of time than not being able to speak that good, but understanding.
So they were getting the emotion from the melody, the speech melody?
Yeah, they were getting, yes. They were not trying to get the words. They were trying to get the context, and the context was there. And then when they're trying to get the single words and there's, oh, I don't know this one and I don't know that one, they're just confused. It's not about when you're writing, yeah, it's about the one exact word, but the whole thing of communicating is about the sound
and the rhythm. And how does rhythm affect you when you translate, Katie and Aicha?
I'm gonna jump in because my relationship to music is different because I'm a dancer, not professional by a long shot, but music for me goes to my feet, and I do try to hear the rhythm when I'm translating, both in the original and in my English version. A lot of translators talk about how they read things aloud, and I never do, which I probably should, but I do try and make sure that my English has a definite rhythm and it has a beginning and an end, sometimes it might fade out at the end, like at the end of a song, or it might just come to a sudden standstill, and that I'm not sure how consciously writers do that, how they play with that rhythm throughout, say, a chapter, whether they think about, okay, is this ending on a high or a low note? How fast am I telling this story? But I think I try and be aware of those sort of musical factors when I'm reading and when I'm translating. Probably less when I'm reading, actually, than when I'm putting it into English, because I have to create something of my own there. And that's one of the things I really enjoy about translating, is getting the sound right, yes, and not just the single words. And it takes a little bit of revision and rethinking, and it's great fun.
I do. How about you?
I realized this week, so we're translating the third book, and I hadn't done any for 3 weeks, or probably longer than that. Sorry, Katie. And so there was a period where we were doing events, and we did a podcast as well, where I've been reading it a lot, and then I come back to it, and I feel really conscious of how things like land, like, because they don't land the same way in my head as they do when I read them out loud. But then sometimes I think, do things not, are books always meant to be read out loud? Maybe sometimes yes, sometimes no. Like, not all books are always going to be like read aloud, and maybe you've got a different voice in your head.
When I'm writing, I usually try to hear it in my head, and for years I was like, I should be reading the book aloud while proofreading, because then I will be able to get all the, let's not call them mistakes, where all the rhythmical things happen which I don't like. And I just didn't do it until the last book, and that was good. It really helped, and I will do it every time now. I hope I will do it. But before that, I was always like, yeah, I should do it, but I just didn't do it because I know what it sounds like in my head, but that's not enough all the time.
And yet, just because you know how it sounds in your head and then how you read it, that still doesn't mean how the reader is going to hear it. But of course, that's a fundamental issue with writing anyway, that we, you know,
yeah.
Reader's individual interpretation anyway. But I suppose you can get it to sound the way you want it to do. And interesting enough, Jana, that's, I think, one of the ways that I first fell in love with the book was seeing Selim read out loud from it, because, as we heard earlier, he's really good at it and can just entertain a whole room full of people with this beautiful voice. And I think when I first heard the first book, I came away with this warm feeling in my belly from hearing Selim read it. Yeah.
And wanted to read it and translate it.
That's the horrible translator's disease. It's like wanting to make it your own.
Yes, you don't know. You never know how the reader will hear it and how he will read it. Yeah, it's a fundamental question. But then again, there is a certain rhythm when you have like a sentence with only short words, a short sentence or a long sentence. Well, it does make a difference. It may not sound like I wanted it to be for the reader, but still, it's something different when you have the words in another order. Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
The Anatolian blues feel very, actually, very melodic, I should say. When I read the first book, and you may not like this, Selim, but that's how I felt at the time, is I could almost hear my grandmother's voice telling me a story. Because every night she used to tell me a story, I think until about I was 14. And it was very animated, always very animated. And there weren't fairy tales. She would just talk about her childhood, which to me as a child at the time was a million years ago.
Yeah,
it was ancient times. You know? So that's why.
Yeah, but why shouldn't I like it? It's the way I wrote the book.
I mean, that's it. It's how I perceived it. It really was like she was telling me a story. That's how it felt to me. So it had that rhythm of a grandmother's storytelling.
I think it's
very a big compliment, because that's how I wrote the book in a way. That story makes sense.
But I feel like it has, that's what why people relate to it. Like lots of people relate to sort of the way it's told and the characters, because it's got that kind of tradition of like family storytelling. And I feel like it reminds me of that on both sides of my family. So it reminds me both of being told, like, when Dede lived in the Black Sea, he fought a bear. But it also reminds me of being told, like, Grandad was driving along and he saw this, like, he thought he saw this white stag on a hill, and these people stopped to see it, and it turned out to be an alpaca. But like, wow, this magical white stag, it was an alpaca. But I think a lot of people can relate to that. People have all these really interesting stories. Grandad was never the same after his allotment was washed away in a flood. That's not even my family story. That's my husband's family. But
it's the oral tradition, isn't it? The book carries that oral tradition of storytelling. So I think that's what is most appealing in terms of rhythm to it, not as in terms of a book, but it's the appeal when you, if you are listening to it inside your head in the quiet space of those four walls, if you wish, then it's the oral tradition of storytelling and the warmth and the kindness of Gül.
I miss the word tenderness. Can we put in
tenderness? Tenderness, yes. Yes, tenderness, actually, yes. Yes, kindness and tenderness, because she is, and she's a very, I find her very determined mother. I think when it comes to, she's tender towards her children, but she's a rock when it comes to doing what she needs to do for her children. And as you were saying earlier, Katie, put up with all sorts of things just because of the children. She doesn't really mind that, but yes, tenderness, the tenderness of the book and the love with which all the characters, including Fuad, I think we're going to have to say that, including Fuad, are painted before our eyes. So I have one last question, and that would be, when would we be able to read the autumn of Gül's life and how she develops?
That will be next spring. We're in the thick of it. I'm certainly really enjoying it, being right up close again. It makes it complicated talking about 52 Factory Lane in the afternoon when I have been translating the third book in the morning. But yeah, March or April of 2023.
Wonderful. And Salim, what is next for you?
I'm working on too many projects right now.
Too many projects.
Yes, it's because of the pandemic and because schools closed down and I couldn't work because I had my little daughter at home. And then I was like, okay, I have to start things which pay the rent. So I have to get some grants, some advance payment for projects. I have to make money without working, and I just try many things because most of them probably won't work out. And I knew if everything worked out, it would be too much work to put into 1 year. And I'm very happy. Nearly everything worked out. I have all this money on my hands, but now I have finished all these things. Currently, I'm writing a novel about a guy, an Albanian who grew up in Germany, who wrote an anti-fascist novel and is becoming big in the literary scene in Germany, and how he deals with it as an upcoming author, and how people tend to misunderstand him just because he's... The main problem here is writing an anti-fascist novel doesn't make you anti-fascist. He is a more... I like that word. He's a way more tender guy than the usual anti-fascist would be, and he knows that he can make some money out of being leftist anti-fascist. But he's not, which doesn't make him right wing, but he's not about ideologies. So that's the main, one of the main topics of the book. So how do we make a connection without talking left and right and fascist and anti-fascist. How is it possible to get people together on a different level? Where is the common ground where we don't see the other one as the enemy and you're just on a, how do you say that in English? On a high horse, like your moral ground is, yes, you're absolutely, you're right about everything. And it's just the other ones. And we tend to be like that. People tend to be like that. They think if more people were like me, this world would be a better place, but it wouldn't.
Yeah. Thank you, Salim. Thank you.
That's one of the projects. I don't start talking about the other one. It takes too long.
Okay, well, I think we can leave it at this. Thank you so much to all three of you for joining us and for sharing your experiences with the Anatolian Blues trilogy, not just with the writing and translating, but also the relationships with the characters. And I'm sure every single person who picks up the books will enjoy them thoroughly, because they're just wonderful. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
This has been German author Salim Özdoğan and translators Katie Derbyshire and Aysa Türkoğlu on the novel 52 Factory Lane, out in April 2022 from V&Q Books. And we've enjoyed an excerpt from this work bilingually. You've been listening to Bowery Poetry Speaks, an audio series of talks and performances with that special Bowery perspective. This series is executive produced by Traffica Europe Radio. Thanks for listening.